supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
President Donald Trump addressed assembled lawmakers this afternoon at the ongoing Republican retreat in Center City, Philadelphia. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Aside from broadcasting speeches, the press is not privy to the work being done by those in attendance. Taking time from the proceedings and joining me live with perspective is Tom MacArthur, two-term Republican congressman from New Jersey's 3rd District, encompassing parts of Burlington and Ocean Counties. Congressman MacArthur, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure, Dave.
Congressman, you serve on two House committees, Armed Services and Natural Resources. So I'm curious, what did you learn to date that will apply to your work on those committees?
Well, actually, Dave, I have now moved to financial services. So my areas of focus certainly are in national security and in trying to get our economy moving again, and especially the areas that are the foundation for our economy, and getting people access to credit, and trying to do the things that will help our businesses and our communities grow.
Congressman, you said during the election season, quote, "Nobody's going to confuse me for Donald Trump," adding that you didn't agree with everything Trump stood for, but nonetheless supporting the president. You were the only one of 6 Republican New Jersey House members to attend. How would you assess much of what you've heard so far at the retreat in terms of supporting Donald Trump?
Well, Dave, I think what's important, and I think what's somewhat refreshing, is actually very refreshing. This president is doing what he said he would do, and you know, if you listen to the style and you get caught in those things, I think that can be a mistake. Look at what he's done. He is taking steps to strengthen our borders, which I think is important. He's taking steps and encouraging Congress to take steps to repair a badly broken healthcare system that's getting worse by the day, and I, you know, I have voted just in the last week to slow that process down a little bit, but nonetheless, I think it's important that he's moving forward and that he's encouraging Congress to move forward and get it right and repair this system. And he's taking steps that I think will help ultimately not only bring taxes down but get our economy going again. So I'm encouraged by it, and I don't have to agree with everything the president says it does. That's the beauty of democracy.
Toward the end of bolstering the economy, he says one of those steps entails massive regulation reduction. Let's listen.
We've issued executive orders to remove wasteful regulations that slow down commerce and delay infrastructure, which we desperately need. The very beginning of a massive effort to reduce the crushing regulations on our economy.
Congressman, you're a former mayor of Randolph, and prior to that, an insurance executive, CEO, York Risk Services Group. You spent $5 million of your own money in that initial campaign. How would you assess this effort to reduce regulation? How, for example, might it affect your prior industry?
Well, I think it affects every industry, Dave, and it's desperately needed. This idea that bureaucrats in Washington can better tell industries how to run is just, I think, a false idea right from the beginning. Regulation is certainly appropriate for controlling bad actors, and every industry has them. But most people in business are trying to do a good job. They're trying to serve their customers. They're trying to create value. They're trying to uplift their employees and their families. And when bureaucrats aren't even in those industries start telling everyone how to do it, this centralized sort of big brother knows best, one size fits all, it ends in stifling growth. And so I'm very supportive of these efforts to take a step back, stop the over-regulation, and focus on the things that really do control people that are taking advantage. That's what we should be focused on.
Congressman, the president also focused today on what he referred to as bad actors. Let's listen.
Just look at the 30 largest cities. In the last year alone, the murder rate has increased by an estimated 14%. Here in Philadelphia, the murder rate has been steady, I mean, just terribly increasing.
Congressman, that's not true. Actually, the murder rate is down some 3% in Philadelphia. And when the president, for example, speaks about widespread voter fraud, there is no evidence backing that up. You asked earlier that we not pay attention to the specifics of some of his words, but are you troubled when you hear the president go off in these directions?
Well, Dave, I don't know every detail of every city in this nation. I guess nobody does. So I can't speak to rates of violent crime. I do know one of our chief priorities as a government is to keep our people safe. And so I think is important. And obviously, we have to make sure when it comes to the voting issues, there's two critical pieces to that. One, everyone who is eligible to vote should have that opportunity. And we have to make sure that there are no efforts that suppress the vote. And at the same time, we have to make sure people don't vote who aren't eligible to vote. And I support those issues. The details of voter fraud in different parts of the country is more than I know. I've not heard reports of that in my state, but I can't speak to other parts of the country.
Congressman, another busy day tomorrow?
Yes, a little less so. Today we had the president, we had the vice president, we had the prime minister of the United Kingdom, plus a lot of our own internal leaders. So it has been a busy day. We've been with both the House and the Senate yesterday and today. And I think we've made good progress on a number of fronts. I'm going to continue to fight hard to make sure we get health care right. I was one of nine who voted no on moving forward a week and a half ago, nine Republicans across the country. But we're past that now, and I'm going to keep fighting to make sure that we get this repair of our healthcare system right, make sure we don't pull out the rug from under the 20 or so million people who are either in the Medicaid expansion side of the program or in the Obamacare marketplace.
I'll let you get back then to that and other important fights. Thanks so much for taking time to join us on Newsworks tonight.
My pleasure, Dave.
Tom MacArthur, Republican Congressman from New Jersey's 3rd District, live on the line. Thousands of anti-Trump marchers are continuing to fill Philadelphia streets with chants and protest signs. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, demonstrators are using a Republican retreat at the Lowe's Hotel in Center City, where Donald Trump made a visit today as a background for their resistance.
Somewhere in the droves of boisterous protesters was Elise Smith of Bucks County. She was being pushed in a wheelchair by her friend. They both were protesting the planned repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
If they get rid of pre-existing condition, I will either be uninsurable or I will not be able to afford the payment. So that's it. So it's ACA or nothing.
Smith was a nurse for 3 decades before a neuromuscular condition put her out of work. She says she's seen firsthand the coverage Obamacare has extended to the uninsured.
Before ACA, because I'm in nursing, I've seen them turn down people because they had a nodule in their neck at 22. They will use any excuse for a pre-existing condition.
She admits that Obamacare wasn't flawless, but
we were lucky we got that through.
Elsewhere in the crowd was Dorothy Mayfield of South Jersey. She held a sign that said, "Hands off Obamacare." She worries about the human toll of some of the Trump administration's proposed deregulations.
We're going to need Obamacare because we don't know what we're going to be eating, where we're going to be sleeping, what air we're going to be breathing, because with deregulations, this is going to be a serious world to live in.
Near the Lowe's Hotel, Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross watched the protesters with some other cops. He said he's pleased that there have been no clashes or arrests so far.
By and large, everyone has been peaceful and cooperative with us. You know the template we take, pretty much hands off and respectful of people's rights to demonstrate and protest.
It's peaceful right now, but to some demonstrators, the night is young and the crowds are still roaring. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
In addition to inspiring many to stage protests, the November elections have also been the impetus for others to take action of another kind. WHYY's Katie Colinari reports that in Pennsylvania, Democratic and Republican women are clamoring to enter politics.
On a recent Sunday afternoon, 25 women are sitting in a union hall in Northeast Philadelphia. They're listening to a presentation on one of the first steps of running for elected office, filing petitions.
So petitions are theoretically like one of the last bastions of like real democracy, right? It's you go out into your community and you get signatures to show support that you should be on the ballot. In practice, petitions are a grueling, terrible process during the worst three weather weeks of the year.
These women are the second class brought together by Emerge Pennsylvania. It's the state chapter of a national organization devoted to helping Democratic women run for office. It offers an intense six-month training in every aspect of campaigning, from door knocking to fundraising. Executive Director Ann Wakabayashi says more than 100 women applied to this year's program, and the timing was notable.
My email comes to my phone, and so it was just buzzing constantly the day after Election Day with people signing up for our email list. We saw a bunch of likes on our Facebook page. We saw all this interest, and so I checked our application status, and I noticed that we had a couple more applications started, and it just kept going up and up and up.
So what's driving this interest?
I feel like sometimes like a fire is welling up inside me, and you know, if I don't have a constructive outlet for it, I might go crazy.
Natasha Taylor Smith is an attorney from Montgomery County who's part of Emerge Pennsylvania's class this year. She's actually run for office before. In 2015, she campaigned to be a Common Pleas judge and lost. Then last fall, Taylor Smith volunteered for the Clinton campaign and was heartbroken when her candidate lost her bid to become the country's first woman president. Despite these setbacks, Taylor Smith is ready to dive back in.
I want to support candidates who I believe are progressive. I want to be a progressive candidate myself.
This was not what Dana Brown expected. Brown heads up the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics at Chatham University in Pittsburgh.
Many of us thought that if she lost the presidency, then that would have a chilling effect for women, that women would see perhaps how she was treated, perhaps negatively by the press or by other outlets, and that is just the complete opposite.
In fact, Brown's been getting flooded with inquiries for the university's bipartisan Ready to Run program coming up next month. For the first time, she had to create a wait list for the training in Pittsburgh.
This is completely unprecedented for this program. I mean, the room literally is at capacity. We could be breaking fire codes if we allow any more women in.
If Brown sounds giddy about this phenomenon, she is. Here's why. Despite the fact women make up 51% of Pennsylvania's population, they make up less than 20% of the state legislature. Studies have shown women face several barriers to running, including fears about asking for money and lack of party support. Brown says this new trend is being driven by Democrats, who are fired up after major party losses and the election of a polarizing president. But she is also seeing an uptick in the number of Republican women interested in running for office for the first time. On a recent weeknight, Michelle Roop was among the crowd of women at a Mediterranean restaurant in a strip mall in Lansdale. It was the monthly gathering of the Montgomery County Republican Women's Leadership Group. Roop was brought here by a friend who's recruited her to run for the North Penn School Board, and she's feeling rather uneasy these days.
Scared to death. I have absolutely no idea what I'm in for.
Roop was an early supporter of President Trump, and she thinks his surprise victory played a hand, albeit a subconscious one, in her decision to run.
I really thought about how different he was as a candidate. And he's not that classic politician. He's a businessman. I have my own small business. It really got me thinking that, you know, maybe politics isn't as scary or as difficult as what I thought it was. And maybe you really can keep your soul and still run and be an elected official.
Roop says having guidance and support from other Republican women who are energized by their party's big win is making her journey to the ballot easier. So what'll it take to turn this influx of interest into election wins? Debbie Walsh leads the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers. She says the number of women in Congress and in state houses across the country has been stuck around 20% for several years.
The pace of progress has been glacially slow.
Walsh says that's because leaders of both the Republican and Democratic parties, many of them men, have not focused enough attention and resources on getting women to run. But after the so-called Year of the Outsider and the historic women's marches last Saturday, Walsh says they just might.
I think as both parties try to think about how do they get more voters to the polls for their candidates, and if voters are looking for outsiders or for new faces, that women, in fact, in many cases, are those new faces.
Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
New Jersey has the dubious distinction of having the highest foreclosure rate in the nation, and housing advocates in turn are pointing a finger at leadership at the state level. Let's get into it with NJ Spotlight Joe Terrell, who recently wrote on the topic. Joe, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Sure thing.
How bad is bad?
Well, it's not as bad as it was. It's just that New Jersey has consistently, since the onset of the Great Recession and the purported recovery, New Jersey has consistently lagged the rest of the nation. We're much better than often in terms of housing values and the number of new foreclosure cases now than we were a few years ago. But over the past year, there were close to 35,000 new foreclosure cases filed in the state courts, and that compares to about 18,000-20,000 in the first few years of this century. So once the housing recession hit, we sort of got stuck. And while other states have climbed out fairly quickly, there's a lot of housing markets around the nation that have rebounded to where they were or better than before the recession. Much of New Jersey continues to tread water, and several areas, especially Atlantic City, are doing worse, consistently worse than they were.
If you were to, though, factor out Atlantic City and also Trenton, which doesn't lag far behind, and also if you factored out the lingering effects of Hurricane Sandy, would that then elevate the Garden State back closer to average?
Well, I suppose if you factor out the worst areas of any state, it would look better. I think you have to look at it as a multiplicity of problems rather than just, well, if we got rid of that one thing and didn't count that, we'd be fine. New Jersey is well behind most states and has consistently been.
And with that, let's take up the contention of housing advocates pointing a finger at Trenton.
You know, I would have said prior to this recession and this aftermath that it's hard for state government to accomplish a lot economically. But since there are so many outside factors that weigh into what's happening, but certainly, New Jersey has not distinguished itself with its forceful action, let's say, in these areas.
Relative to other states?
Relative to other states and relative to the need. There's some other states that have worked better with their housing agencies and nonprofit groups, and I think that's what Jessica Brooks from Boston Community Capital talks about, that her experience coming in year after working with other states where they were welcomed by the governor and, you know, connected to state agencies that were working with nonprofit groups, is that there's, you know, sort of a vacuum at the top here. It's a lot more haphazard system. A lot of the nonprofit housing counseling groups are struggling, as she puts it, to keep the lights on, and they're not necessarily getting a push from the state government. Famously here, Governor Christie used $75 million from a national housing foreclosure relief settlement to plug, you know, one of the many gaps in his various budgets. You know, that was sort of a high profile example of funds that were specifically supposed to go to people who were in need of foreclosure assistance that were diverted elsewhere. And, you know, it just hasn't been an issue that the state has paid much attention to. It's a situation where there's very few people in government that have been consistently advocating for people who are in the foreclosure process or threatened with foreclosure or otherwise having some difficulties with their mortgages.
Joe, thanks for offering perspective on Newsworks tonight.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
NJ Spotlight, Joe Terrell. There's a new show in town, and it's right here at WHYY. Common Space is a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, bringing together personal storytelling and news documentary. The premier program and podcast entitled Being a Black Man is a Full-Time Job features a conversation between men of different backgrounds, exploring what it is to be an African-American male today. Here's Iraq War veteran Russell Walker's story.
I can't remember a time where I didn't know that I was a black male. My grandma, who is like one of the brightest black people you could ever meet, she was racist as I don't know what. She can't stand white people. And it may be because she came from that time, you know, that you did. So they have a different experience with white people than I had. But as I said, I've always known I was a black man. I've always known that there's kind of like a fine line of me being arrested, me being killed, me being treated less than in some way. But then my father moved us to South Philly. The school I went to, which was Abigailville Elementary, was like America was supposed to be a melting pot. This school had every black, white, Hispanic, Asian. We had everything in the school. So it was like that school, like it showed me something else. It showed me that there's a world where everything doesn't have to be about color. That was the early years of that school. Later on, there was a K through 8 school. So in about fifth grade, my best friend who happened to be white called me a nigga. So that at that moment, it was kind of like it's always there. Not that you can't trust people, but racism is never completely gone from people. You know, it's learned. He may not really dislike you, but he may have heard people use that word when they're mad at other people or when they think another person is beneath them. So, yeah, I've always known, you know, who I was and that I was a black male and that in this world there are certain things that I gotta look out for more than other people, other males.
Iraq War veteran Russell Walker, and you can hear more of his conversation with fellow African-American men on Common Space, premiering Sunday evening at 8 on WHYY and continuing on the last Sunday of each month at that time. Themes include immigration, mental health, personal relationships, community politics, fathers and sons, and more. The podcasts are at acommonspace.org. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.